We can't know what sex in heaven is until we know what sex is. We can't know what in heaven's name sex is unless we know what on earth sex is. But don't we know? Haven't we been thinking about this incessantly? In fact, for almost nothing else, for years and years. Isn't that the essence of a sexual revolution? What else dominates our fantasies, waking and sleeping, 24 nose to the grindstone hours a day and night? What else fills our TV shows, novels, plays, gossip columns, self-help books and psychologies, and through advertising our entire economy, except sex? And my answer is almost anything but. I do not think that we think too much about sex. I think that we think hardly all about sex. We dream, we fantasize, we feel, we experiment, oh yes, but honest, look it straight in the face, thinking? Oh, hardly ever. I know of no subject in the world about which there is more heat and less light. So I want to give you some very dull light. Four abstract philosophical principles about the nature of sex, which I think are absolutely necessary not only for sanity about sex in heaven, but also for sanity about sex on earth. We lack such sanity. The fact that sex is public doesn't mean that it's mature and healthy. The fact that there are thousands of how-to-do-it books on the subject doesn't mean that we know how to do it. In fact, it means the opposite. It's when everybody's pipes are leaking that books on plumbing sell. My four philosophical principles will probably seem strange or even shocking to many of you. Yet they are not original. They're the primeval platitudes known to most pre-modern societies. Yet they are in another way radical. The word radical comes from the Latin word radix, which means roots. These are our sexual roots. And our uprooted society is rooting around looking for sexual substitutes like a pig rooting for truffles. The fact that we have not found our truffles should at least make us look back at our roots. So here's the first principle. Sex is something you are before it's something you do. Suppose you saw in the bookstore a book with the title, The Sexual Life of a Nun. You'd probably assume that it was some scurrilous, gossipy sort of story about dark tunnels connecting convents and monasteries and clandestine rendezvous behind the high altar and masking a pregnancy as a tumor. But the title is a perfectly proper title. All nuns have a sexual life. They are women, not men. When a nun prays or acts charitably, it is a she who prays or acts charitably. Her vow of celibacy forbids sexual intercourse, but it cannot forbid her to be a woman. In everything she does, what she is, that is her essence, plays a part, and her sex is part of her essence, just as is her age and her sense of humor and her race. The phrase having sex today usually means merely the temporary act of sexual intercourse, or even less, masturbation. The older, deeper meaning is something we all have all the time, our sexuality, our sexual nature. Of course a nun has sex. She's female. Draftees used to fill in the box on their induction form labeled sex, not with the word male, but with the word please, or sometimes occasionally. The joke would have been unintelligible to our remote ancestors. The significance of the linguistic change is that we have trivialized sex into merely an act that we do rather than a quality of our inner being, a thing of surfaces and external feelings rather than personality and internal feelings. Thus, we call even masturbation having sex, though it's exactly the opposite. It's a denial of real relationship with the other. We call homosexual acts sexual, although they too are a denial of the relationship with the other sex. That's what hetero means, other. The words masculinity and femininity mean something much more than merely biological maleness and femaleness. What do they mean? Well, we no longer know. They used to be archetypes. Now they've become stereotypes. Traditional expectations were that men be men and women be women, but today we no longer know what to expect men and women to be. Yet, though our expectations are confused, they remain. our hearts still desire the so-called stereotypes that our minds reject. I saw a very interesting study a while ago, a racial study in America, that shows that something like 10 times more white women marry black men than vice versa, and 10 times more white men marry Asian women than vice versa, because Asian women are perceived by white men to be very feminine, and black men are perceived by white women to be very masculine. Whether that's only perception or reality, the types remain, even though it's politically incorrect to talk about them. I think the main fault in the old social stereotypes, which had to be loosened up, was their too tight connection between sexual being and sexual doing. Their tying of our sexual identity to social roles, especially for women. The feeling that it was somehow unfeminine for a woman to be a doctor or a lawyer or a politician. But the antidote to this is not confusing our sexual identities, but locating them more deeply in our being rather than, first of all, our doing. And in that way, we can soften up our social roles without softening up our sexual identities. In fact, a man who is confident of his inner masculinity is much more likely to share in traditionally female activities like housework or baby care than one who reduces his sexuality to his social roles. Well, if we accept this first principle, that sexuality is part of our inner essence, then it follows immediately that there is sex in heaven, whether or not we, quote, have sex in heaven, and whatever we have as distinct sexual roles in heaven, if any. Second principle, the alternative to sexual chauvinism is not sexual egalitarianism. These are the two most popular philosophies of sexuality today, and they seem totally opposed to each other. And yet, at a most basic level, they are in deep agreement and each deeply mistaken. The two philosophies are the old chauvinism and the new egalitarianism, and they certainly seem totally opposed. For chauvinism is based on two assumptions, it seems. First, chauvinism sees one sex as superior to the other. This is usually the male. There are also some strident female chauvinist voices in the current cacophony. And this presupposes a second assumption, namely that the sexes are intrinsically different, different by nature and not by social convention. If something is by nature superior to something else, then it's by nature different. The opposite philosophy, sexual egalitarianism, tries to disagree with the first principle that one sex is superior to the other, totally. And it thinks that to do so, it has to also disagree with the second principle, namely that the sexes are by nature intrinsically different. But there is a third assumption common to both chauvinism and egalitarianism. Namely, the assumption that all differences are somehow differences in value. That the only way for two things to be equal in value is for them to be equal in nature. Both chauvinism and egalitarianism make the same mistake. They see the only two options as sameness or superiority. And it is from that third hidden assumption, the assumption that all differences are differences in value, that the chauvinist argues that the sexes are different in nature, and that's right, and therefore they're different in value, and that's wrong. And it is from the same assumption that the egalitarian argues that the sexes are not different in value, and that's right. And he concludes that therefore they are not different in nature, and that's wrong. Once the common false premise is smoked out, it's easy to see how foolish both arguments are. Of course, not all differences are differences in value. Are dogs better than cats, or cats better than dogs? No. Or is the difference between a cat and a dog only a difference of social convention, not by nature? Of course not. Chauvinists and egalitarians should both read the poets and the songwriters and the mythmakers to find a third philosophy of sexuality that is more sane and more interesting. It denies neither the rational truth that the sexes are equal in value, nor the wonderfully irrational truth that they're innately different. Vive la différence. So, if sexual differences are innate and natural, they are preserved in heaven. Because our nature, our essence, is not demeaned or bypassed, grace does not destroy nature, it perfects it. But if our sexual differences are only humanly and socially conventional, then heaven will remove them as it will remove economics and politics and penology. Not many of us have job security after death. That's why I'm a philosopher. Don't want to change jobs. But things like disease and crime and even lawyers came only because of the fall. Sexuality came as part of God's original package. Be fruitful and multiply. That was before the fall. Some people think the fall had something to do with sex. Well, it certainly didn't consist in sex because that was the first commandment. God might unmake what we make, but he certainly won't unmake what he makes. God made sex, and God doesn't make mistakes. St. Paul's frequently quoted statement that in Christ there is neither male nor female does not mean that we get castrated in heaven. First of all, it doesn't refer to heaven, it refers to earth. We are in Christ now. In fact, if we aren't, we're not going to get to heaven. But we are male or female now. His point is simply that our sex doesn't determine our in-Christness. God is an equal opportunity employer. But he employs the men and the women that he created, not the neuters of our imagination. Third principle, sex is not just biological. Sex is most deeply spiritual. When I say sex is spiritual, I don't mean vaguely pious and ethereal and idealistic. Spiritual doesn't mean a liquor or a perfume, something arising from specially gifted souls into the nostrils of a receptive heaven. Spiritual means a matter of the human spirit or soul or psyche, not just the body. Sex, even Freud says, is between your ears before it's between your legs. In other words, we have sexual souls. For some reason that seems strange to me, I'm strange because I try to think rationally, and that's absurd, many people are shocked by the notion of sexual souls, absolutely shocked. I find this among my students one of the most unacceptable notions, one of the most strange. People not only disagree, they think the idea is repugnant and incredible and superstitious and crude. I wonder why. Because the idea is the only alternative to either materialism or dualism. For a materialist, everything's made of matter, so there is no spiritual soul. So, of course, sex isn't a quality of the material soul. There isn't any spiritual soul for sex to be a quality of. If you're a dualist, you believe in the soul as well as the body, but they're two separate substances. You've split the body and the soul completely. You're a ghost in a machine. And then one half of the person can be totally different from the other. One half can be sexual and the other not. The body can be sexual without the soul being sexual. But no good psychologist is a dualist. The evidence for psychosomatic unity is overwhelming. And therefore, no pervasive feature of either the body or the soul can be insulated from the other. Every sound in the soul echoes in the body. Every sound in the body echoes in the soul. Just as pain cannot be felt either by a ghost or a corpse, the same is true of sex. So let our rejection of dualism be premise one of my argument. And let premise two be the more obvious fact that biological sexuality is innate and natural. It's in fact pervasive to every cell of our bodies. It's not socially conditioned or conventional or environmental. It's hereditary. Combine those two premises, rejection of dualism, that is psychosomatic unity, premise one, and premise two, biological sexuality is innate and natural to the body. And the conclusion that follows is that sexuality is also innate and natural to the soul. There is spiritual heredity as well as physical heredity. That's the assumption behind the doctrine of original sin. The only way to avoid the conclusion that we have sexual souls is to deny one of the two premises that logically necessitate that conclusion, either to deny the psychosomatic unity or to deny innate somatic sexuality. In light of this simple argument, why is the conclusion not only unfamiliar but shocking? I can think of only a couple of reasons. One is that we might be Gnostics, we might be dualists, we might be spiritualists. We're into spirituality rather than religion. Whenever I go into a bookstore and I look at the sections and there's a section on spirituality, distinct from religion, it's always bigger. It's New Age stuff. It's comfortable stuff. Christians have a religion that's not spiritual. Christianity is incredibly material. It believes that God really created a really material world and said it was very good. It believes that God is a material being ever since the incarnation. God has a human body and soul. He didn't take it off at the ascension. He took it to heaven with him. And he used it to redeem us. And if the blood hadn't dripped from Christ's body at the cross, if he just came with good preaching and good intentions, we would have no hope of heaven. And if you were in that crowd that was looking for a healing one day, and you were that woman with the issue of blood that hoped to touch the hem of Christ's garment and be made whole, and with utter sincerity and good faith, you reached out and touched the hem of somebody else instead, thinking that it was Christ, you would not have been healed. The power would not have gone out. Christianity is a very material religion. It's not spirituality. But of course, if you are a spiritualist, if you're something like a Hindu, matters merely maya or illusion, well, then it makes a lot of sense to say sex doesn't go all the way up. It's just a matter of the body, and that's to be left behind by each reincarnation. A second reason why people are shocked by the notion of spiritual souls is that they think of it in too simplistic a way. They don't know enough anatomy to realize that there are two hormones in everybody's body, male and female, and that it's a matter of degree rather than simply a matter of presence or absence. And the same thing is very likely true of the soul. In Jung's terms, there's anima and animus. There are female, or rather feminine, qualities and masculine qualities. It's a matter of proportion. Maybe if the dominant sex of your soul isn't the same as the dominant sex of your body, you have a sexual misfit, a candidate for some sort of therapy or even sex change operation, heavenly or earthly. And maybe heaven supplies such changes, just as it supplies all other needed forms of healing. I don't know. But in any case, the resurrection body must perfectly express the soul, and since souls are innately sexual, the body will perfectly express its soul's true sexual identity. Jesus didn't look like a woman after the resurrection. I think a third reason why people are shocked by the notion of sexual souls is that they're really Hindus who think they're Christians. They're really pantheists. They see spirit as a kind of undifferentiated infinite pudding. They think of spirit as simply overwhelming all the distinctions known to the body and the senses. That's not the Christian notion of spirit or of infinity. Infinity is not undifferentiated. God is infinite, but he is not the blob God. He has very definite, specific attributes. He is righteous, not unrighteous. He cares. He does not not care. He is good, not evil. He is wise, not foolish. Each of these attributes is infinite, but it's a very definite infinite. So spirit is not less articulated, less structured, less formed than matter, much more so. You know that. Your own spirit can suffer and can rejoice far more delicately, far more exquisitely, in a far greater variety of ways than your body can. You sometimes want to distract yourself from spiritual pain by physical pain, which is why when you're in deep spiritual despair, you tear your hair out or hit your head against the wall, thus causing physical pain. How foolish, not at all. The physical pain distracts you from the far worse spiritual pain. Differences in general, and sexual differences in particular, increase as you move up the cosmic hierarchy. They don't decrease. And God is infinitely differentiated because he's the author of all these differences. If you look at the creation account very carefully in Genesis, you'll see that God, after the first act of creating the universe, each of the days of creation is a differentiation of light from darkness, of sea from land, of life from non-life, of plant from animal, of species from species, and of man from woman. Creating means forming, differentiating, unless you're a pantheist, where forms and differentiations are only illusions, or you're a materialist, which is also a kind of pantheism. Everything is just matter. But if you're not a pantheistic spiritualist like a Hindu and say everything is only spirit, and if you're not simply a materialist like the Marxists, then forms are willed by God. They're designed. They're works of art. And sex is one of the most important of those forms. The conclusion from these principles is that we will have to admit that there is something like sexuality in God himself. Because whatever is positive and good in the creature must flow from something in the creator. Actually, it's not correct to say that God is like anything else, but it is correct to say that everything else is something like God. So there's something in God that human sexuality is an icon or a mirror of. More about that later. The fourth principle is perhaps the most pervasive in all pre-modern cultures, namely that sex is cosmic, it's not just human. Almost every language in the history of the world, except ours, English, attributes sexuality to things. English is the only language that I know that doesn't have masculine and feminine nouns. In all other languages, trees and rocks and ships and stars and horns and kettles and accidents and ideas and trips, these, and not just men and women, are masculine or feminine. Why? If I were to ask you, you'd probably spontaneously say, well, it's projection. It's personification. It's a reading of our sexuality into nature. Couldn't it be the other? Couldn't it be reading nature's own sexuality out of it? By the way, we call it. Others call it her. Obviously, nature is a she. A supernaturalist should know that. If you're a naturalist, if you believe that nature is all that there is, then nature has no character. But if you believe that nature is a creature, then she's got a character, and she's definitely she, and God is definitely he. Just as you don't understand the English language well, you don't appreciate it unless you learn another language. So you don't understand men except if you appreciate women. You don't understand women unless you appreciate men. You don't understand nature unless you appreciate God. You know things only by differentiation. This idea that sex goes all the way down and all the way up, that something like sexual differences are present in all of nature, is one of the most widely held ideas in our history, and I think one of the most beautiful. It's a happy idea because it puts humanity into a human universe. We're not freaks. What we are, everything else also is, in different ways and in different degrees. We are, to use the medieval word, a microcosm, a little cosmos, a universe in miniature. And the universe out there is a macrocosm, the same pattern written large. We're more like little fish inside bigger fish than we are like sardines in a can. It's the can that's the projection. If sexuality goes all the way up, it also goes all the way down the cosmic ladder. At the down end, there's love among the particles. Look at the nature of gravitational and electromagnetic attraction. To use an old but still useful model, that little electron just seems to know the difference between the proton, which she loves, and another electron, which is her rival. If she didn't know the difference, she wouldn't behave so knowingly, orbiting around her proton and repelling other electrons, never vice versa. Oh, but you say that's only the balance resultant of two merely physical forces of angular momentum and electromagnetic attraction. The angular momentum tends to zoom the electron out of orbit, and bipolar electromagnetic attraction tends to zap her down into her proton. So there's a stable atomic structure only because there's a resultant between the zoom and the zap. There's too much zoom for a zap and too much zap for a zoom, so you get neither fusion nor fission. That's right, but what right do you have to call physical forces mere or merely? And how do you account for the second of those two forces, electromagnetic attraction? Why is there attraction between positive and negative charges? It's exactly as mysterious as love. In fact, it is love. The scientist can tell you how it works, but the lover knows why. In fact, even the medievals knew that gravity was love. What's the last and most famous line in Dante's Divine Comedy, the greatest poem ever written? What does Dante finally perceive in the beatific vision when he sees God and understands the entire universe in the light of God? It is this: the love that moves the sun and all the stars. So I say sex goes all the way up and all the way down, and therefore spirit is no less sexual than matter. On the contrary, it's more so. All contrasts are richer and deeper and sharper and realer as we rise closer and closer to God. The God of the Bible is not a tapioca pudding with everything being just a lump in him. God is not a light that outdazzles all finite lights and colors. Rather, he brings out all finite lights and colors. And therefore, in an analogical sense, God is the most sexual of all beings. This is shocking only if you reduce sex to the biological, or if you're a Unitarian rather than a Trinitarian. The love relationship between the Father and the Son within the Trinity, the relationship from which the Holy Spirit eternally proceeds, is an obviously sexual relationship, though it's not biological. It's very much like the human sexual relationship from which a child proceeds in time. Or rather, that relationship is somewhat like the divine one. According to the Bible, sexuality is the image of God. Read the book, Genesis 1:27. God created man in his own image. In the image of God created him. What's the next words? Male and female. For B to be an image of A, A must in some way have all the qualities that are imaged forth in B. And if we are made in God's image, and if we are psychosomatically unified creatures, if the image of God is not just the soul, if the soul is the soul of the whole body, then it follows that God is a sexual being. And therefore, of course, there's sex in heaven. Because in heaven, we're closer to the source of all sex. As we climb Jacob's ladder and get closer to heaven, the angels look less like the neutered greeting card cherubs and more like Mars and Venus. Another reason that we will be more rather than less sexual in heaven is that all earthly perversions of true sexuality will be overcome, especially the master perversion, selfishness. To make self into God, which we all do all the time, to desire your own will and your own selfish pleasure as the good, is not only to miss God, but to miss pleasure and your own good as well, and to miss the glory and joy of sex. Jesus didn't merely say, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God." He also added, "And then all these other things shall be added." When you put first things first, all second things flow better as second. Each story of the building fits better when the foundation is put first. C.S. Lewis calls this the principle of first and second things. In any area of life, putting second things first loses not only the first things, but also the second things. Any addiction is a clear manifestation of that principle. An alcoholic cannot appreciate alcohol. So to treat sexual pleasure as God is to miss not only God, but sexual pleasure too. But to treat God as God frees you to experience sexual pleasure as God designed it, which is much more passionate and joyful. The highest pleasure always comes from self-forgetfulness. You know from experience that self-remembering always spoils a pleasure. Pleasure's like light. If you grab at it, you miss it. You become a kind of spiritual hypochondriac. You worry yourself sick about worrying yourself sick. If you try to bottle the light, you get only darkness. But if you just let it pass, you can catch the glory. If you try to conquer the wave, you can't do it. You get wiped out. But if you follow the wave, you can surf. I think the self has a built-in God-imaging design of self-fulfillment by self-forgetfulness. That's a deep principle that most religions in the world understand in some deep and profound way, not just Christianity. Their explanation for it is inadequate, but in almost all our deep wisdom traditions, this principle of lose yourself to find it, or the ego is there to be transcended, they understand that. Because they're human and they have human experience. We all know that when we're thinking about ourselves, though we have to do that sometime, check ourselves out, we can't experience deep joy, that the deepest joy comes through self-forgetfulness. And even some remarkable physical manifestations happen that way. When Edison was working on the electric light bulb, he was so fascinated with his work and so self-forgetful that he never slept more than 10 or 15 minutes at a time for over a year. But he remained quite healthy. It's amazing what you can do when you have a self-forgetfulness experience. Well, that's what we're designed for in heaven, standing outside yourself. That's why the mystics say such strange things like, "I looked into myself and I found nobody there but God." I guess a Hindu would mean, "I am God," but that's not what the Christian mystic means. He means, "I became totally transparent. I didn't get in my own way. I wasn't standing in my own shadow anymore." That's not the self-conscious self-sacrifice of the philanthropist. That's the spontaneous, unconscious self-forgetfulness of the lover. Well, I think that deep principle that the greatest pleasure comes from self-giving is graphically illustrated by sexual intercourse. and by the very structure of the sexual organs, which must give themselves to each other in order to be fulfilled. And I think that's an image of something in heaven. When all egotistic perversions are eliminated, all pleasure is increased, including sexual pleasure. Well, then, am I suggesting that there will be physical sexual intercourse in heaven or not? Well, I obviously don't know. But I think we will have sex organs in heaven. What will we use them for? I think we will have gastronomic organs in heaven. Jesus had a mouth in the resurrection. And actually, he ate some food when the apostles offered it to him. I don't think he had to, but he could. So will we have sex in heaven? Well, I think that's similar to the question that C.S. Lewis reports as being asked by a six-year-old boy whose father tried to explain to him the pleasures of sexual intercourse. And the boy said, "Can you eat chocolates while you're doing it?" To the boy, eating chocolates is the highest pleasure in life. But he didn't understand the father's laugh. "Well, yes, you can, but you won't want to." "Not want to eat chocolates? How could that be?" Will you have sexual intercourse in heaven? Well, if you want to eat chocolates while you're having sex on earth, then maybe so. But what would we use our sex organs for in heaven? Not making babies. Earth is the breeding colony. Heaven is the homeland. And not for cementing marriage. Christ's words to the Sadducees are pretty clear about that. It's in regard to marriage that we are like the angels. Notice Jesus doesn't say that we're like the angels in not having bodies. That would be absurd. But might there be another function in which baby making and marriage are swallowed up and transformed? Yes, but I don't think we know what it is. Everything on earth, I think, is analogous to something in heaven. I don't think heaven simply removes or simply continues unchanged any earthly things. So if we apply that to sexual intercourse, we get the conclusion that intercourse on earth is a shadow or symbol of intercourse in heaven. What would that be? Well, the saints call it the spiritual marriage. Remember, sex is spiritual. And therefore, since sex is spiritual, there will certainly be sexual intercourse in heaven. With God, we will participate in the very life of the Trinity. Maybe that also extends to universal sexual understanding of all human beings. But if half of us in heaven will be male and half of us in heaven will be female, will there be then no distinction between homosexual and heterosexual spiritual sexual intercourse in heaven? No, that remains a difference. I have no idea, and nobody else does either, and I don't think it does any good to speculate any more than the boy wonders about chocolates, what the physical manifestation of that is going to be in heaven. But that something will take the place and fulfill what we do on earth, I think that's pretty clear. Maybe it'll be a kind of sharing in each other's secret without shame and voluntarily, getting into each other's spirit. Isn't that what lovers want the most? Even in the height of sexual intercourse, even the best love relationship is inadequate because you want to become the other. You want to get inside them. You can get inside their body a little bit. Can you get inside their soul a little bit? But you want to do it completely, and you can't. There's a deep secret of loneliness, of alienation. I'm just me and not you. Lovers who speak poetically often say, "I don't just love you, I want to be you," without ceasing to be me. I think that's an intimation of what we can be in heaven. Rather than speculate more about heavenly chocolates, let's speculate more about what we do know a little bit about, namely the relation between earth and heaven. If some sort of spiritual intercourse with God and with the blessed in heaven is the ecstasy that is hinted at in all earthly sexual intercourse, physical or spiritual, then that would be the ultimate reason why sexual passion is so strong, so different from all the other passions, so heavy with suggestions of profound meanings that just elude our grasp. Look at all the earth's poetry. How much is written about eating? How much is written about recovery from disease? How much is written about mere survival? Not much. How much is written about sex? An enormous amount. Sex isn't like anything else. God invented it first. No mere practical need accounts for this. No mere animal drive explains it. No animal falls in love. No animal writes profound romantic poetry. No animal sees sex as a symbol of the ultimate meaning of life, because no animal is made in the image of God. It's human sexuality that is part of that image. And human sexuality, I think, is the foretaste of that self-giving, that losing and finding of the self, that oneness in otherness that's the heart of the Trinity. That's what we long for. That's why we tremble to stand outside ourselves in the other, to give our whole selves, body and soul, because we're images of God, the sexual being. And this earthly love is so passionate because heaven is full of passion, of energy, of dynamism. We correctly deny that God has passions in the passive sense. He's not driven or conditioned as we are. But to think of the love that made the worlds, the love that became human and suffered alienation from itself and died on the cross to save us rebels, the love that gleams through the fanatic joy of Jesus' obedience to the will of his Father, the love that shines in the eyes and lives of the saints, to think of that love as somehow less passionate than our temporary and conditioned passions is a most disastrous fantasy. And it's that consuming fire of love that's our destined husband, according to his own promise. Sex in heaven, indeed. And no pale, abstract, merely mental shadow of it either. It's earthly sex that's the shadow. And our lives are a process of thickening so that we can share in the substance, becoming heavenly fire so that we can rejoice in the heavenly fire. John Paul II is great for a number of reasons. I think his single greatest achievement is the answer to the sexual revolution. It's what he calls the theology of the body. And I highly recommend a number of books about it. He's not a good writer. No pope in history has ever been a very good writer. You don't have to be a good writer to be a good pope. But there's a number of good books about it, such as Christopher West's The Theology of the Body Explained, and Steve Kellmeyer's Sex and the Sacred City, which is much shorter. Let me try to summarize what he adds to this as the answer, the flowering of something that was there always. This is not radically new. It's a growth process, but his pulling on the riches of the whole Christian tradition to see the body in a theological way in relation to God. He starts with the notion that the human body is an icon, a holy picture. The original unity of man and woman, as he says, has been lost with the fall, but not totally. So that when a man looks at a woman and when a woman looks at a man, we see a small and perverted version of what Adam saw when he looked into Eve and Eve saw when he looked into Adam, that absolute wonder that we now experience in a great cathedral or hearing a great symphony. This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. This is the meaning of my life. This is my other half. For some reason, Christians have been accused, and I suppose sometimes justly, for being puritanical. Actually, the Puritans were quite sexy. They had a lot of kids. The word should be Victorian, I guess. Have been accused of a kind of Gnostic attitude towards sexuality as being something wicked and embarrassing and dirty. Nothing could be farther from the truth. God invented it. God glorified it. God made it the means of the most astonishing miracle that we can possibly partake in. Procreation. Creation. What do you mean creation? Look, when animals have sexual intercourse, what follows necessarily and genetically and biologically is just another animal without an immortal soul and without a relationship to God. But when we have sex, what by divine design follows is the act of creation out of nothing. God creates a new immortal soul out of nothing that has infinite value and is destined for eternity. And that's where we came from. That's absolutely astonishing. He won't do it without us. He created the angels without any help. He will not create us without any help. We have to give him help. There's no job that's more important than that. But he made it come through sex. He could have sent babies down by storks. He could have created them out of nothing. That would be much more reasonable. Little children, when they're first told how babies happen, often don't believe it. The stork is much more rational. You heard the joke about E.T. coming down out of Mars and landing outside of Detroit and meeting Henry Ford III. And he says, take me to your leader. And Henry Ford says, I am the leader. I own this factory. Come and take a tour. And he sees how cars are made. And Henry Ford says, do you have factories on Mars? And E.T. says, well, yes, but we don't make cars there. We make people that way. My goodness, how do you make cars on Mars? Well, tell me first how you make people on Earth. So Henry Ford tells E.T. how we make people on Earth, and E.T. laughs and says, that's how we make cars on Mars. Making people in factories is no less or no more astonishing than how we make people. What an incredible invention. Another emphasis in John Paul's theology of the body is the connection between sex and the Trinity. He doesn't quite go so far as to say God is a sexual being. That can be easily misunderstood, but something very close to that. Why is there sexuality at all? Why didn't God just make us monosexual? Is it simply because we are like the animals? Do the animals determine us? Is that the image of God? Our animality? Or is the image of God from above? Well, if it's from above, then how can it be sexual? Well, because sex is spiritual. That relationship between the Father and the Son is a relationship of self-forgetful, self-giving love. When Christ comes into the world, he says, my whole purpose is not to do my own will, but to do the will of the Father. That's love. It's not philanthropy, it's love. And in eternity, that love between the Father and the Son, the fact that the Father isn't first the Father and then chooses to give himself to the Son, but rather the Father constitutes his fatherhood by his gift to the Son. The Son is the mind of God, the thought of God, the Logos. And the fact that the Spirit proceeds necessarily from that unity, that the Spirit is the breath of the love between the Father and the Son. In other words, God thinks of himself so really that his thought eternally is another person, and those two persons love each other so really that the Spirit is eternally the result of that. That's a beautiful image of human sexuality. Here are two beautiful pictures that we've had for a long time, the Trinity and sex, and we've looked them to the north and to the south, and we haven't put them together. And they're like a key and a lock. They have the same shape. And then comes the fall. The fall into selfishness. Not just selfish behavior, but self-concern. We use the word I, which is the holy word that God reveals as his very own essence. The only time he names himself and tells us who he is eternally, his name is I am who am. We use that word as the center. It's almost inevitable that we look at ourselves as the center and God as something maybe superior to us, but out there somewhere. We think of God as ingredients in our religious experience. No, we are ingredients in God's religious experience. Lust is sex perverted by selfishness. Lust starts with I want. And even if it behaves nicely, it starts with the I instead of with the other. And it's not just a question of philanthropy or altruism or correction. It's a question of spontaneous psychological starting point. You look at a picture of your high school class and you're the first person you look at. Why? Don't you know what you look like? We're playing God all the time. Right now, I am here standing, and to me, you are all down there sitting down. To each of you, you are the one sitting down, and I am that other up there who's standing. Now you're to my right. Now you're to my left. See how I'm playing God all the time. I'm the center of the universe. It's almost impossible. It's not almost impossible. It is impossible to escape that without divine grace, and even there, then only gradually. So it's very difficult for us to imagine what sex was like before the fall. It wasn't just polite and proper and unselfish. Thomas Aquinas says that sexual pleasure must have been unimaginably greater before the fall than after, because anything in its natural God-designed state is more pleasant than in its fallen state. But still, we're only partially fallen. We're not doomed. We're not despairing. We still have the image of God. We're still masterpieces, though defaced masterpieces. And therefore, sex is still, to us, God's call to come out of ourselves. It's a way that we can't deny. Well, I guess we can. But it's very hard to deny that we are fulfilled only by the other, not by the self. And this also gives a new view of the family. Not totally new, but a new appreciation of the family as God's school of saint-making. You can't have a family and be selfish. It's simply impossible. The kids make too much demand on your time. Either you give it or you don't. And if you give it, you give it either with joy and voluntarily or without joy and involuntarily. So there's two ways to have a bad family and one way to have a good one. And it's surprisingly easy to have a good one. Not a perfect one. There are no perfect families except the Trinity. But if being a saint means, first of all, being unselfish, then I think the most powerful tool that God ever invented in making people unselfish is the family. And that, too, of course, is an image of the Holy Family. That is, ultimately, the Trinity. The need for this vision, which I've just given you tiny and confused sketches of, right now, at this time in history, when the sexual revolution has virtually destroyed the family, is acute. If you were to ask me, what are the two most dangerous inventions of the 20th century, I would say the atomic bomb and Dr. Rock's pill. They both can have disastrous consequences upon the origin and the end of all of human life. If the pill means that sex has now changed its meaning and is divorced from procreation and family and can become a recreational tool, we have taken a divine miracle and reduced it to human fun. And we're not getting much fun out of it. Remember the point about the books on plumbing. I've exceeded my time. Do we have time for questions?
I think I have a question, but I might not be entirely sure of the facts of it. I am remembering in the Bible when Jesus' disciples asked about the woman who was married to two men and whose wife will she be? And in my brain, because I don't have a Bible to look it up, I believe the response was something about there not being sexuality or something like that. So I was just wondering if you could maybe elaborate on that.
Matthew 22. The Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection. They didn't believe in life after death. So they used this case in Jewish law, which is required, a man must raise up seed to his dead brother, to ridicule the resurrection. In the resurrection, whose wife will she be? And Jesus says, you know neither the power of God nor the resurrection. First of all, he says, in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like the angels who don't marry. So there's no marriage in heaven. It doesn't follow that there's no sex in heaven. Even on earth, you can have sex outside of marriage, but it's forbidden. Maybe it's not forbidden in heaven, because it's probably a different kind of sex. But the main point is, as to the resurrection, then, he says, I'm quoting from memory because my memory in this case is better than my glasses. as to the resurrection, then he uses a beautiful piece of midrash, that is spiritual interpretation of scripture. The Sadducees accepted only the first five books of Moses as scripture, and not the later books of the Old Testament. And nowhere in the first five books of Moses is there an explicit statement that there is life after death. But Jesus finds one by connecting three of the names of God, which are given in the first five books of Moses. He says, have you not read the passage about Moses in the burning bush, where God says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he also says, I am not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now, put those three names together. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were dead for 400 years when he was speaking to Moses. Then he uses the present tense, I am, not I was. And add to that, he's not the God of the dead, but of the living. And then Jesus says, because all live in his presence, thus proving the eternal presence of all of us to God. That's brilliant. That's the main point. The point about marriage is sort of preliminary, and there's no point about sex. So that doesn't prove that there's no sex in heaven.
And I had another thought or question as well about the idea of when people use contraceptives, they're separating God's intention to be producing something through the sexual act. Mm-hmm. If we are saying that there is no separation of the body and the spirit, is it possible that by having a physical sexual activity, you are producing something spiritual rather than physical?
Certainly.
And if so...
But to lock the door when you think God might want to visit you is an affront to God. That's what contraception is.
Could it not be that that which is analogous to our sexuality in heaven is what we will be corporately as the church to Christ? And wouldn't that obviate the need for us to have an individual sexual identity?
Yes to the first, no to the second. The church is she. The church is Christ's body. Christ marries the church. It's not a homosexual marriage. And the church is also not a harem. It's not churches. When Christ comes at the end of the world, he will not marry a harem. It's one church, one body. And it's a quasi-sexual relationship. God didn't, in a fit of absent-mindedness, just happen to incarnate himself as male rather than female. He could have incarnated himself in two people. One male, one female. He could have incarnated himself in a female. He incarnated himself instead in a male. Why? Because the church is female in relation to him. And in fact, the human soul is female in relation to God. The word for soul is anima. In fact, Christianity, the Bible, is closer to female chauvinism than male chauvinism. To God, we're all women. Which is why the Jews never had priestesses. They were the only ancient religion that had no priestesses and no goddesses. And which is why the Catholic Church follows that tradition in not having priestesses. Not that women can't perform any function that men can. They can certainly teach, they can counsel, they can hear confessions. They're not inferior, but they're images. It's not simply what can they do properly, but who are they? Jesus Christ is not a woman. We are in relation to him spiritually. There's a lot more to it than that, obviously. And I don't expect everybody to agree with it or even to understand it.
This question is actually kind of trivial to your talk, but it popped up. You're talking about how most languages assign common nouns with male or female, and how that kind of... And then you suggested that that's not a projection of our gender upon nature, but
that
just recognizing nature's gender. But aren't they given different sexes in different languages?
Surprisingly, not much. The consistency is amazing. For instance, in almost all polytheistic religions, all the male gods inhabit the skies and all the female gods inhabit the earth. Almost always the night is female and the sea is female, whereas the day and the land are male. The sun is almost always male and the moon is almost always female. There are a few exceptions, but there's a pretty consistent pattern. By the way, there was and remains a controversy about how to talk about God. And many clergy people want to revise the Bible and not use the word he or him. They think that's male chauvinism. At Harvard University, there was a controversy about it. The feminists, first of all, decapitalized the he, but it was still he, so they changed it to he or she as the pronoun for God. And the feminists said, well, we're still second-class citizens, we're still second, so they changed it to she or he. And then came the environmentalists and tree huggers. Yeah, hey, you forget about the environment. Let's add it. So they put she or he or it as the pronoun for God. But that was too long, so they condensed it to one syllable. That's Harvard.
Hi. Maybe you already clarified this in the talk, and I just wasn't keen enough to pick it up. But you had said that we're living in a society that is confused as to sort of like what our sex is, and that we have to be our sex rather than being something just that we do, and the difference that it's not just our social roles, there's more to being masculine, and that it's deeply innate, or being feminine, being deeply innate.
Yeah.
How do we, as a generation that's grown up in this world that is confused, because I think that was beginning...
Listen to your heart more than your society.
Right, and so, but for those who are perhaps aren't as good at listening at their heart or whatever, like, is there an antidote?
Well, we all do. God designed the heart. He didn't design the society.
Okay.
There's a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom in there. Okay, this is going to have to be the last question.
You've used human to animal a fair bit in a couple of the talks. When people conflate animals and humans, how do you talk with them about that?
I tell them not to invite me home for supper. Because if they're vegetarians, I'm not hungry, and if they're cannibals, I'm afraid. There's two ways of conflating humans with animals, to raise the animals up and to lower humans down. Almost always it's the second. I've met very few people that believe, a few, but not many, that believe that chimpanzees can be taught to be philosophers and that porpoise language is as complex as Greek or Latin. We just don't understand it yet. That's an interesting flaky idea, but relatively harmless. And I have no quarrel with the idea that animals are much greater than we think they are, and they're much more human than we think they are, and that some of them are almost trembling on the brink of human personality. And we're tempted to say, almost, welcome to the human race. Not quite, but almost. My basset hound, when he looks at me with those big brown eyes, is having a mystical experience. He thinks I'm God. It's very embarrassing. But the other is an insult. To say, I'm nothing but an animal. That's a deep insult. That's like saying to a criminal, you're nothing but a victim of society. You're not to blame for your crime. You don't have free will. You're just a machine. That's a deep insult. It's often done in the name of compassion. We put animals out of their misery because there's nothing else there. They can't be called to true dignity or courage, but people can. And people often respond much better than we think they will.